You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Lark and Termite, Jane Ann Phillips' latest novel, takes place in rural West Virginia, where the half-siblings of the title live with their maternal aunt. Termite is a damaged child, unable to walk or talk, who is lovingly tended by his sister. The book is about love and family, war and betrayal, and the mystical bonds that sustain us, sometimes defying time and space. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Jane Ann Phillips back to the show. It's good to see you again.
It's good to see you.
Did you set this novel in the 1950s because you saw it as a more innocent time?
No, I don't actually think it was a more innocent time. I'm not sure we've had any innocent times. I set it in 1950 because 30 years ago, I was in my hometown, Buchanan, West Virginia, visiting a friend, and looked out her second-story window onto a grass alley. Several houses fronted on the alley, and in the front yard of one of them, facing the empty alley, was a sort of 1950s aluminum lawn chair. And in that chair sat a boy who had his legs folded up under him as though he couldn't feel any sensation in them, and he was holding up to his forehead a long blue strip of dry cleaner bag, a sort of a blue streamer. And he was blowing on it repeatedly so that it moved in front of his eyes, and I asked my friend, well, who is that and what is he doing? And she said, I don't know. He sits that way for hours. So that boy, in a sense, was the beginning of the novel, though, of course, I didn't know it at the time.
Well, nowadays, people would say he was probably autistic. And Termite here sounds like he is both autistic and has cerebral palsy.
Well, one reason I set his section of the book in 1959 was because I didn't want him to be labeled necessarily as one thing or another. He actually has a compendium of so-called disabilities.
And he'd probably have 32 diagnoses today, whereas he has none at this time.
He has none. I mean, Noni is told a couple, she mentions a couple of things that she was told about him. She also says they wanted to open his head and look and see what was really wrong with him, and she said no. But he also is an extremely prescient, perceptive person. He can't communicate that to other people, but the people who really live near him sense it from him, and the reader is able to sort of enter his perceptions because one of the points of view in the book represented in a third-person voice is Termite's point of view, something I'd never intended to write when I started the novel, but was just compelled to try to represent how he thought.
When you decided that you were going to do a number of different voices here, so how do you come up with the voice of somebody who is echolalic and who really has problems communicating? Is it more like writing poetry than prose, finding that voice?
Well, I think my writing in general has to do with writing the way a poet may write. I started out writing as a poet. And voice really leads me into a book. The first voice in this book was Lark's voice. And the first line in the book was, I move his chair into the yard under the tree, and then Noni carries him out. And I think that's because I first saw him sitting in this chair, and I was trying to answer for myself those questions, who is he and what is he doing? In terms of Termite's point of view, I tried to enter the language really a lot through rhythm and through the repetition of images and patterns. And there are italicized sections in which he's sort of slipping in time and giving us something that happened several years ago, but it's somehow brought to him in a very intense way by some memory.
Well, that kind of simultaneity has led many reviewers to see connections between this Termite and Benji in The Sound and the Fury.
Well, of course, I love that novel, and I've probably read it several times, but I think there's a real difference in that I see Termite as sort of the opposite end of that continuum, in that Benji is represented. Faulkner once said that Benji's an animal. He wouldn't recognize Caddy if she walked into the room. And Termite is very definitely his own person. He's rather willful. He sees images that he himself doesn't recognize. And also the Compson family was sort of in decay. It was sort of falling apart. It was a kind of metaphor for the decay of the South. And the family in this book is actually a very strong and rather, in the end, triumphant family who pull together partly because of this focus on Termite.
Well, the book takes place in two places. It takes place in West Virginia, and you've said it's clear to me by now that the wife fled early. I am one of those people who never left home.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also in Korea, and it really begins in July 1950, on the day that Termite is born and his father is killed in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think the Korean War has been less of a source of fiction than some of the other wars the United States has been involved in?
I think it had to do with the timing, with the fact that it was right after World War II had ended. People had a kind of shiny sense of possibility. It was the culture of the 1950s. It was not nearly as questionable, or it didn't question authority the way, of course, we began to question later. But the Korean War was actually like a rehearsal for Vietnam in many ways. It was a United Nations war action. It was North versus South. It was an enemy that Americans couldn't recognize without a uniform. And I actually, when I began the book, I was in Lark's voice, and she informs the reader that she knows that Termite's father died very early in the Korean War, and this whole world is described that includes a double railroad tunnel that the children play in. It's a sort of space for them. And in my imagination, it was a kind of WPA construction of chiseled stone. They're very common and beautiful in West Virginia. And when Martha Mendoza and her colleagues broke the story of Nogun Rhee in 1999, there was a big color photo of this double railroad tunnel, and I looked at it and recognized it really as the image I'd been thinking about in West Virginia, and it became clear to me that that was what had happened to Lovett.
So you read the newspaper story of this this, what do we want to call it, massacre in Korea during the Korean War?
I think we'd call it an atrocity. I mean, I think war itself
is like an earlier My Lai kind of incident.
I think war itself is atrocity. And a war, once unleashed, you know, war is atrocity. And both sides in all wars, I think, commit atrocities.
Were you thinking about the current situation when you were writing about this? Or did you really just wind up in the 1950s?
No, I was thinking about the current situation. I mean, Lovett says at one point, it's all one war. And another character in the novel says later on, you know, when a soldier dies, it really goes on for a generation because he leaves people behind. And I think that's something we're really dealing with every day in our current situation.
My guest is Jane Ann Phillips. Her latest novel is Lark and Termite. It is published by by Knopf. You really establish yourself initially with very different kinds of things, with short stories and with novels that had, you told stories from the viewpoints of murderers and the like. Have you mellowed over the years?
Not at all. I mean, I've done other things about war. Machine Dreams was very much about the Vietnam War and World War II. Shelter was about a group of children. This book also concerns children. I think my obsessions through, 35 years are actually connected to one another, and I pretty much see the work as a continuum. I don't think a writer writes one book without having written the books that came before.
Social services would probably target any parent who named a boy Termite today. Why isn't the name a problem for the people around him?
Well, in the South, people had all kinds of names. And the name Termite really comes from the fact that, you know, so Noni says early on, he was so small for his age that we used to just call him a mite. And they don't know his real name because they never get his birth certificate until the end of the book. And mite sort of became the word termite, partly because one of the things termite does is kind of move his fingers constantly, as though he's almost hearing something or feeling something through them, sensing something through them. And that led to sort of this delicate idea that, you know, he's almost like an insect's antennae, and they end up calling him termite.
On the other hand, the name Lark has all kinds of redeeming and optimistic qualities ascribed to it. And was there a reason her mother named her Lark?
Her mother says, I gave her a name that would keep her safe and let her fly away, and hope she'd stay safe and fly away. So that was Lola's idea about the name Lark. But Lark, the name Lark, has a wonderful sort of thread, I think, through our culture. There's that wonderful song with the line, the sweet silver song of the lark, you know.
Mm-hmm. Skylark is another very pretty
Skylark
song.
Yeah.
Noni, the person you keep on referring to, is their maternal aunt, and she's mm-hmm. really the person who's bringing them up. And I don't want to go through all the details of the story, and mm-hmm. Because there are surprises along the way, but she's an appropriate person for that role. We mentioned Faulkner earlier, and I guess one of the most quoted lines from Faulkner is "The past is never dead." In fact, it's not even past. And I do get a feeling that that's something that you think about when you're writing books like this.
I do very much, because I really think the only difference between someone who lived in 1950 or someone who lived in 1510 is the fact that they're existing at another point of time. I mean, I think human concerns have remained very much the same. And I want the reader to be able to enter this world that's very clearly set in the 1950s, but to feel a real connection to themselves and to what we're living in now.
You've said in other interviews that you believe that when a person dies, a lot of the relationship still exists in a kind of netherworld. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the power of yearning is very strong. And in this book, a number of lives are brutally interrupted by an event that no one sees coming. And there's almost a sense of eternal present about memory and about even a sense of loss. I mean, I think many times we don't know what we're missing, but we somehow live through or act out the unresolved dilemmas of our parents. I mean, this book takes a couple of surprising turns and comes around to, in a way, resolving a lot of loss.
There's also a flood. Were you thinking of Katrina when you were writing about that?
Not consciously, but I mean, we used to have floods in my hometown, not huge floods, but the water coming up in the back of the house, right up to the yard, every time the stream grew swollen. I mean, here, war and the flood are almost counterparts.
Well, there's something biblical about both of those things.
Yeah, well, war is a kind of catastrophic man-made weather that once unleashed, again, can't be controlled. And the flood has that same feeling of inevitability and catastrophe to it.
You've spoken often about your resistance to writing. It's not a profession like deciding to be a dentist. It's something you can't help doing. I think it's something you're called to, like being a nun or working in a leper colony. Boy, you don't make it sound very attractive.
Well, I think being a nun can be very attractive.
I was thinking of that leper colony.
Well, that could be attractive, too. I mean, I think the sense of doing something that really matters changes one's life. It changes the direction of one's life. And I think that writing is difficult and lonely work, and you don't do it purely for reasons of ego or to see your words in print. I think you do it as a kind of act of redemption about stories that would be lost, things about maybe your own family that would be lost, and also about finding meaning. I mean, I think fiction is the sort of slow appropriation or approbation of meaning. We're sort of imposing meaning on a world that might seem random, or actually finding meaning, discovering the meaning that's there.
Do you think that writers also work with society's outcasts? I mean, do they see themselves as outsiders? I know I have a writer in the family, and every so often in the middle of a meal or something is going on, his eyes will suddenly drift off, and we all know that this is going to work its way into something somehow. It's not going to sound like this, but, you know, something is happening there. The writer's mind has taken over.
Well, I think the writer is a kind of double perceiver or sort of split observer.
But then we also have the lepers that I was talking about. They're outsiders.
They shouldn't be, though. I mean, I think that literature, history gives us the facts, but literature tells us the story. Literature tells us what the story means. And in fact, I think, for instance, at Rutgers Newark, where I direct the MFA program, we have a wonderful reading series called Writers at Newark. We have 14 fabulous writers there every year. And we have a high school program based on the series. We send excerpts from the work to the high school teachers in Newark that are in the program, and they work it into their curriculum, and they bring their students to hear these writers. And I think that, you know, it's a shame that people don't read for meaning, for support, for to sort of be beckoned forward the way they did before media became so important in our culture. I mean, I think that literature can give us something that none of the other arts can provide, which is that sense of really entering into the mind of the book. I mean, we read I Cross the Street, that becomes the voice in our own heads. So it allows us to exercise a kind of empathy that we simply don't feel in any other way. Even watching films, which I love to do, you're watching something on a screen. It's not inside you the way literature is.
Many people have described reading as a collaboration.
Exactly.
And if I see a movie, I'm seeing what's on the screen. But if I'm reading a book, I'm reading a different book from the next person.
Exactly. And language has that capability. It has a kind of unconscious power. Even the root words of words, the way words develop over time, is something that we bring to reading.
Just one more thing. Your short stories, when you first came on the scene, really struck people as being unlike any others. And I haven't seen too many recently. Have you stopped writing short stories?
The stories are in the novels.
That's what's happened to them?
That's what's happened. They're in the novels. The poems are in the novels. And, you know, my books aren't exactly conventional. They're very much informed by language and the connection of one theme to another, one word to another. So I would say that they're inside the novels. And this novel certainly has plenty of stories in it.
Jane Ann Phillips' latest novel is called Lark and Termite. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It was great to be here. Thank you.